Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of March. We are going to learn so much this hour. Did you know that we all come from the sponge? I knew that somewhere a long time ago, but I forgot about it. And we are all the sponges were the first definite animals, and we come from a sponge. That will change the way you go through this whole day, won't it? The author of a beautiful, fascinating book, A History of Earth in 100 Groundbreaking Discoveries, will be joining us, Douglas Palmer, in just one moment. But as you know, this is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive, and I'm delighted to have in our studios Rhonda Fanning, the terrific producer of this program, and we are here to ask you to invest just 3 minutes of your time in your own future. Our goal to ensure that all of the programs you value, including this one, are here on Wisconsin Public Radio when you want them. A contribution of any amount will do that. Please make your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hello, Rhonda.
Hello, Kathleen. I just want to mention really quick that last hour they had a goal of 200 pledges, and they did end up hearing from 131 people. So they were very close. This hour, of course, we start over. We have a new goal of 45 pledges. So to help us meet this important goal, make a contribution now by going to WPR.org or dialing 888-202-2552. Your gift ensures that the programs you enjoy here on WPR every day continue.
We know that you're intelligent people, and so Rhonda really tries to aim high. She doesn't try. She does aim high and hits high every day. We do our best to bring you in-depth, thought-provoking discussions every day, like this kind of conversation you'll never hear anywhere else, A History of Earth, 100 Groundbreaking Discoveries. Because you appreciate these conversations that you get on the Ideas Network, please make a pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And this is kind of cool. We have something special going on this drive. I think it's the first time we've done a trip to London. Larry Mueller is taking a garden tour of London and the surrounding area with WPR listeners. You can find out the details when you make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, we'll be speaking with Douglas Palmer from Cambridge, England, about his beautiful book, A History of Earth in 100 Groundbreaking Discoveries. Discussions like this one are possible just because of your financial support. Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin Public Radio listeners become Wisconsin Public Radio contributors for various reasons. One of the main reasons is they want to make a difference. So giving to Wisconsin Public Radio is one way you can make a difference and help your local community.
Your pledge not only pays for the programs you listen to, it also gives other people in your neighborhood the chance to discover Wisconsin Public Radio. Make that difference and give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And today you're going to enjoy WPR pledge-free after 1 o'clock this afternoon. But to make your pledge-free afternoon possible, we need to pull together during these morning hours. So please give your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It'll help keep this pledge drive efficient. And thank you in advance.
We still need 42 more pledges in how many minutes, Rhonda?
We have about 50 minutes left.
Thank you, Rhonda. Mm-hmm. So please help out now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thank you, Rhonda, for
Thank you.
All that you do. We're going to talk about why we are all SpongeBob SquarePants or Betty SquarePants, and many, many, many issues concerning the Earth this hour. It's going to be, I'm really looking forward. As a matter of fact, I was sitting at the dining room table. I read the book, and I said to my family, I have a great idea. We're going to read this book chapter by chapter until we know all about the Earth. And they agreed. They couldn't do it yesterday, but they agreed because it's just absolutely fascinating. Our guest this hour is the author of A History of Earth in 100 Groundbreaking Discoveries, science writer and lecturer on earth sciences for the University of Cambridge Institute of Continuing Education. Douglas Palmer is our guest, author of more than 20 books, consultant for BBC Wildlife Magazine, and a regular contributor to New Scientist and Science Magazine. There are 100 different discoveries, which with absolutely gorgeous pictures, and it looks at dinosaurs and our common ancestors, mega floods, sea levels, the composition of Earth, the core of Earth, and the list goes on and on. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our on-air number today is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can send an email if you'd like. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Douglas Palmer, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, good morning to you in Wisconsin. I hear you have a beautiful day there, just as we do here in Cambridge this afternoon.
Is it beautiful in Cambridge?
Absolutely, yes. Record-breaking temperatures for this time of year.
It's a little too warm, I think, but we'll talk about that during the course of the hour.
Can I just add my support to your request for these pledges for your public broadcast radio? I mean, I think it's... You know, it's such a wonderful thing to have, and that to enable us to have a conversation like this across the Atlantic about a science book, I think is, well, it's remarkable, and I hope people actually enjoy it and see it as worthwhile.
I think they do. And I think they will pledge and say that it is worthwhile. Your book, in addition to be phenomenally interesting, is just beautiful, Douglas. The pictures are gorgeous.
It's, well, yes, indeed. That was one of the aims of the book, was to try and get in some new images about science today. And it's, you know, there is such a plethora of absolutely astonishing kind of visual information out there. Unfortunately, a lot of it is still locked up in the kind of technical academic journals. And so it would, one of the ideas was to try and bring some of these to a wider audience and then try and explain some of the things that are actually behind these images, because they're not always easy. I mean, it's really quite deceptive stuff, some of it. You know, we're so used to seeing, on the one hand, you know, satellite images of perhaps bits of the Earth, and a lot of people don't necessarily understand that they're false color images, that the actual original image, you know, is basically because it's not a photographic image, so it's in tones of gray, and these have to be colored. And so that you see these bird's eye view of the Earth from space, and it all looks wonderful, and there's kind of blue and green and brown, but actually they have been colored.
Let's start with where you start, and that's the birth of the planet 4.5 billion years ago. You say, how much can we really know about this remote and turbulent period of our planet's history? How much do we know? How much do we have yet to learn?
Oh, goodness me. It's, you know, on the one hand, it's we've come so far in the last 100 years and in the last few decades, and you know, when people sometimes question things like the amount of money that's been spent on going into space, well, actually that all comes back onto helping our understanding of the origin of Earth as well. The more we understand about the far reaches of space, the more we can begin to put our planet Earth and our solar system in context. And I think it's a very kind of humbling experience. Apart from anything else, the images that come from the far reaches of space are just astonishing. And some people might think, well, you know, goodness me, we're just one tiny little planet and there's all these myriads of other solar systems out there. But on the other hand, isn't it? It's just absolutely magical. And so on the one hand, we are learning more, but on the other hand, and this is, you know, in order to really encourage anyone who has any sort of interest or fascination, young people, in the Earth, there is just so much more to discover. You know, we've got a fairly good idea of the mapping, the details of the surface of the Earth, but, you know, just scratch that surface and get under it a bit, and my goodness me, how little we know, simply because it's very difficult. You know, you could only physically go down a few kilometers with deep boreholes, and then there are other ways of exploring even deeper with various types of instrumentation. But, you know, beyond that, it's still very, very difficult, and it's all about interpretation, and there is just everything to play for.
The water on Earth helps us, of course, live. You write about the fact that we have two-thirds of the surface covered with water, and there was an idea that it was mostly delivered from icy comets, but now we're thinking that it came from rocks themselves. How do we determine that, and did some of it come from icy comets?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that, you know, that again, that the, you know, what people are discovering is going to outer space and looking at more detail and sampling some of these comets. They are made up of, you know, there is ice out there. And so there's, you know, a huge amount of water in that state. And what we do know is that in the very early formation of Earth, there was this, Earth was bombarded from outer space by asteroids. And amongst this material was a huge amount of rock and ice debris. The Earth might not look as if it's been bombarded in that way because it's a dynamic planet. And so the old kind of pockmarks, the old craters, have been reworked and smoothed over. But if you look at the moon, and if you look at the, you know, the far side of the moon, you get a much better idea because the moon was also affected by that late stage bombardment. So Earth originally, there was a stage in early Earth's development when it would have looked like that far side of the moon absolutely just cratered, and that it's all been smoothed over since then. But against that, it's still this question of Earth's inherent rock material and the development of the materials that make up Earth has been a kind of evolutionary development in terms of the elements and the way they have been kind of reworked by the internal dynamic of the Earth. And it's this sort of process that people are beginning to think may well have contributed to the amount of water that is present on Earth. I mean, it's a bit deceptive in that, of course, when we look at the surface of the Earth from outer space, we do see, I mean, there's one angle of Earth, it looks as if the entire planet is covered with water. I mean, if you look, you know, from space at the Pacific is so big, it's just amazing, and the rest of the continents tend to be relatively clustered on the other side. But, you know, nevertheless, that even the deepest oceans have an average depth of not much more than about 5 kilometers or more. I mean, that's pretty deep. And then there are trenches, like James Cameron has just been down and looked in one of the deepest trenches that go much deeper than that. But they're relatively small spaces. So the total volume of water on Earth is in these huge ocean basins is still relatively small compared with the actual mass of the Earth. The main bulk of the material that makes up interior Earth. Mm. And of course it gets, it depends on the depth of the ocean. If you were to shallow the oceans, the sea, the oceans would spread out over more of the land. Or if you to deepen the oceans, the oceans would be more concentrated and would cover less of the surface. So one has to think of it in these terms. It looks very impressive. And of course, to us mere humans, it's difficult stuff because we can only go down unaided, you know, an aqualung or something like that, a few tens of meters, which is nothing. Nothing when you've got an ocean that's 5 kilometers deep. And it takes a lot of technology to do and a lot of money to do a James Cameron and go down into the real depths of the ocean, which is incredibly inhospitable. So the oceans themselves are absolutely fascinating environments. They're very special environments. They're pretty ancient, and of course they have chemical properties, and they're absolutely vital to the well-being of Earth because, in the end, that's where our rainwater comes from. It's ocean water evaporates, goes into the clouds, into the atmosphere, recircled, recirculated, comes down on the land. And then, of course, if you change Earth's climate and have a glacial natural ice age, then interesting things begin to happen as to the amount of water gets locked up in ice and so on. And yet, our oceans and ocean waters, just a fascinating subject in itself.
It is. We've done a couple of shows on this census of marine life, which you cite in your book as one of the groundbreaking discoveries.
Fantastic. Great stuff,
It's interesting that, and you cite this, that only 5% of this ocean that you've just been talking about has been systematically explored. I keep thinking, imagine what's there that will aid us or teach us in ways that we know not of yet.
Absolutely. When you think of it, that when the first oceanographic expedition set out in mid to the latter part of the 19th century, of course, they had great trouble plumbing the depths of the oceans. I mean, you had to have a wire that was 5 kilometers long to get down there. Now, 5 kilometers of wire, however thin it is pretty heavy, and so it's got to be pretty strong stuff. And when you were just trying to take little samples, and they brought them up, they kept them, they just found mud. And so at that time, it was assumed that, and they realized it was dark and cold and muddy on the bottom, and so they just assumed that actually it was a kind of marine desert. There was virtually no life there. And yet since, in the last 100 years since then, there's been this just amazing discovery as better means of sampling the oceans, and the ocean depths have revealed so much, quite apart from the actual topography of the oceans, which that discovery was, was really one of the absolutely groundbreaking ones because it led to plate tectonics. But the actual life of the oceans, as you say, we only know a tiny, tiny proportion of it. And the whole basis of our understanding is being radically changed as people begin to appreciate more and more the actual microbial content of the oceans and the actual number of organisms, microbes, that are in the oceans. And it's just astonishing stuff. And again, we're just at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. We're spending a lot of time these days trying to figure out the extent of global warming, the effect that it's having on flooding, on extreme temperatures that we're experiencing in Cambridge and in Milwaukee right now, on a number of issues. Your book looks at future sea levels. It also looks at mega floods and other things that have happened in our past that may help us inform our present. Let's start with sea levels and what we have discovered in terms of sea rises before and what we've discovered now about global warming making our sea levels go up significantly, and what the future holds.
Yeah, well, one of the easiest ways to perhaps get some sense of it, there you are in Wisconsin. The rocks around you in Wisconsin, a lot of them are very old, over 2 billion years. But you've also, I'm sure, all your listeners will know that you also have a great range of kind of limestones and sandstones that are of, well, technically we know them as sort of lower Paleozoic in age, so the Cambrian, Ordovician, and Silurian age rocks. So these, and there they are, middle of Wisconsin, kind of middle of North America. These are marine deposits, these sandstones and limestones of lower Paleozoic times. And so the whole of North America during those ages was, of course, flooded by the sea. The same for most of the British Isles, the same. Every continent you go to and you look at the rocks around you, and quite often, most of the time, the rocks you're looking at, the actual stratified rocks, are marine deposits. So at one time or another, every single continent on Earth has been flooded by the sea, not just once, countless times. And so sea levels have gone up and down. Land levels, equally for different reasons, have changed as well. But this is normal. Sea levels have changed over geological time. That is, there's a famous curve showing this, and it's not a single curve. It just goes up and down, oscillates up and down across the whole range of geological time. And so this tells us that this, it does definitely fluctuate. Now, the question perhaps how much it fluctuates is more difficult to get a handle on. You read estimates that, you know, maybe 300 meters plus. That's probably at the top of the range. Colleagues of mine who study these things tend to say that actually that's probably a bit too much, but certainly we're talking way over 100 meters. And then you think, gosh, 100 meters, you start raising sea level. You're only going to raise sea level 10 meters. I mean, as we see, you know, the floods, storm-driven surges and things like that inundate low-lying coastal areas bad enough as it is. But then if you to make them, you know, sort of 30 feet high, the inundation will be considerable, let alone going for 100 meters. So that changes in sea level are inevitable. What we have to try and understand is what drives them, what we can do about it, and to what extent we can actually predict when it will happen and how much it will happen. And a huge amount of work has been done on this. And most immediate concern, of course, is to do with the worst-case scenario that global warming is to continue and actually remove the present ice sheets and glaciers from Earth, as has been actually normal in the geological past, in which case all the water that is locked up in those ice sheets and glaciers, and remember, will increase sea level by, you know, a significant amount. We can do things and we can prepare ourselves, but to deny that anything's going to happen seems to me to be, you know, that's the real ostrich act.
Douglas Palmer is our guest, and we're talking about A History of Earth, a wonderful science lesson today. It's in 100 Groundbreaking Discoveries. That's the title of his book. He is a science writer and lecturer on earth sciences for the University of Cambridge Institute of Continuing Education, author of a number of books, consultant for BBC Wildlife Magazine, and he is a regular contributor to New Scientist and Science Magazine. To your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take a phone call. Alex in Black River Falls. Hi, Alex.
Hi, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I had a question regarding the geologic column. I don't think the timescales have changed much since Charlie Lyell, but the proposed millions of years for different layers of strata, all over the world there's polystrata fossils found, which are petrified trees connecting different rock layers, some of them as high as 60 foot. I was just wondering how that would play in with millions of years, because I think it's shown that they couldn't have grown there, and I don't think they could stand up waiting for the rock layers to form around them. So I was just wondering if you had any insight on how they could be through rock layers like that.
Oh, hi. These fossil trees are extremely interesting and, some very important evidence for environments in the past. Now, in Arizona, the famous petrified forest does indeed have these, and I'm sure you've all seen photographs, or some of you may even have visited them, of these huge pine trees whose original woody tissues have been turned into rock. Now, and this rock is often beautiful. It's often the kind of with silica, and that it's kind of almost opal-like silica. The same is found in Australia and elsewhere. But if you actually cut a thin section of some of this material, you can see within it the original traces, the original woody tissues. And what we have to understand here is the process whereby original tree material, wood material, can get turned into rock. Now, it is a bit puzzling. However, if you look at, I mean, two different places. One is the famous Joggins National Park in the Bay of Fundy up there in northeastern Canada. It's definitely, if you get the opportunity to go there, because you could you can see on the coast there are actually layers of strata. They've got layers of coal, and you can see trees going through the, as you describe, tree trunks going through the layers of rock. Now, when you go and actually look at these trees and look at the substance of them, actually what they are is they are infills of a tree-shaped space by sediment. And that sediment was added later. And so what happens is, in these, this is, these are coal measure forests from Pennsylvanian times in Joggins, that you've got, you know, forests with incredibly high productivity. And so you've got big trees, masses of big trees growing close together, shedding their leaves and all that debris piling up. Some of it so thick that it then subsequently forms coal layers. And as it does so, it builds up around the tree roots and the actual trunks of the trees. Now, at various times, these forests got flooded by seawater that killed off the vegetation. Now, as we all know, you can you remember the images, say, of Mount St. Helens?
Sure.
When the whole forests were killed off by the ash. But some, although a lot of the trees were blasted flat, far away from the actual ash falls, quite a lot of the trees were left standing vertical. But only the tops of them, the rest of them, had been inundated, the whole lower part of the tree had been inundated by ash. But wood tissue is very, very tough. And so those trees, and on the flanks of Mount St. Helens and places like that, as their woody tissues eventually degrade, what will happen is some of the ash and other sediment, it then becomes hollow, and the surrounding ashes become hard. So you've got a tree-shaped hollow into which younger sediment will fall and fill up that hollow. Now, because it's sediment, it then is even tougher than the original woody tissue. So that we get these occasional situations in which we get sediment infills of original trees, which their trunks persisted for some time after their death and was then kind of replicated by mineral material. And it's that mineral material that has replicated the shape of the tree, and it's done it so faithfully in times that it not only preserves all the details of the outline of the tree, sometimes it even preserves some of the internal anatomical detail of the woody tissues. And so it looks as if, you know, something very, very odd has gone on, and indeed something interesting has gone on, but it is not impossible. We can see the same processes actually happening today, as I say, at, say, on the flanks of Mount St. Helens from that eruption. How many years ago was it now? Gosh, 30, quite a long while.
Over 30, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that would be how I would explain this sort of thing. Recently, I've just seen similar tree trunks in Glasgow. In the 19th century, of course, Glasgow, famous industrial city in Scotland, and as they were building a park in Glasgow to celebrate Queen Victoria, they uncovered a whole range of these fossilized tree trunks.
Oh.
And the citizens of Glasgow were so impressed by it, and they were so interested in science at the time, that they gathered together and they got money together and they put a roof over it. They covered it over.
Oh, my.
And you can still see it. It's called the Fossil Grove in Glasgow. If any of your listeners ever go to Glasgow,
they should go there, too.
You can go and see it in Kelvin Grove, and it's one of the most famous of these fossil forests.
Huh.
And again, all the details of the actual root structures of the tree. Amazing stuff.
Yeah. All right, a couple more places to go in our lifetime. Douglas Palmer is our guest this hour, author of an absolutely beautiful book and worth reading a chapter a day, and you'll know so much about the Earth. It's a history of Earth in 100 groundbreaking discoveries with gorgeous pictures. We'll continue our conversation and take more of your phone calls. Alex, thanks for your call. Our on-air number is 800-486-8655. Rhonda Fanning joining me in our downtown Milwaukee studios, which seem pretty far away from the forests in Glasgow, but he took me there. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive, and we are here to raise the money that we need to pay for the programs that keep you informed, like this one. This is how WPR works. The people who use it help pay for it. Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 to ensure the future of the programs you count on. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're looking for 35 more pledges in, say, the next 23 minutes. Thank you to those that have already given this hour. If not, help us stay on track by making your contribution right now by going to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I know this has happened to you because it happens to me almost every day of my life. You're right next to the radio and you're drawn into a great discussion and you need to get somewhere, but the discussion is so interesting that you find that you're a little late, perhaps, to where you need to go because you're interested. You appreciate the knowledge of the guest and the caller's questions and views. Because that has happened to you, make your pledge of support so you can have more moments like that in your life, and those are good moments. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And this hour, rather than receiving a book or a CD as a thank you gift, you can do something extra special. I really like this idea. If you give $120 or more, you can select food for $40 as your thank you gift. If you do that, we'll pass on what we would normally spend on that book or CD to a Wisconsin food bank in your local area. So please pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I like that idea, too. Think about why you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio and to this program. Give yourself a little time to think about it and then make your pledge. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You decide your amount and then you have one more choice. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And pledging to WPR is quick and an easy process. To make it even easier, you can switch to being a sustainer. A sustaining membership is one that automatically renews each and every year. You can choose a monthly gift amount, $5 a month, $10 a month, any amount really, and it becomes a sustaining gift.
And as a sustainer, you'll help Wisconsin Public Radio save money because we won't have to send as many renewal notices in the mail. Make the switch, make a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So another 33 pledges this hour to go in the next 20 minutes to help us meet our goal. Help out now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552. And thanks to those people that have already given this hour.
Yeah, thanks very much. And thanks, Rhonda, for all that you do. We are continuing a history of the Earth, a big topic with a wonderful guest who's joining us by phone from Cambridge, England. It's a history of Earth in 100 groundbreaking discoveries, taking you from the very formation of the Earth, what is 4.5 billion years ago, to now, and some of the issues that we are facing now and what remains to be discovered. We're welcoming phone calls for our guest, Douglas Palmer. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we go to June from Shawano next. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
I learned a lot just listening on the telephone.
Did you? Yeah. Isn't it? Oh, I wish you could see the book. It is just beautiful.
Well, I would like to see it very much. Unfortunately, I've already sent in my contribution.
Thank you, June.
I would like to ask Mr. Palmer, Professor Palmer, Dr. Palmer, whatever you're comfortable with, about what's going on in the modern world. And that is the aim of the countries of the North to exploit the many mineral deposits of the Earth that will become available to them through an opening of these waters. I'm particularly concerned about the animals, but that's what I'm asking.
And where was the exploitation? I didn't hear that, June.
The exploitation is in Canada and Russia and all of the countries of the North. They haven't exploited anything yet, but they're claiming the land.
Hello, yes. Mineral exploration and mineral exploitation. This is it's a very, very hot topic, really. Part of our problem as humans is that, of course, our society is built on what we call progress, and that includes economic progress at the basis of it, and we have particular kinds of economies that are ever demanding, and we ourselves are always demanding of new technologies, new devices. I think, our mobile phones, for instance, as far as I remember, I think it's something like at least 20 different materials go into the manufacture of a mobile phone, including a number of really quite rare metal compounds.
Mm.
And, we want phones, and so we have to get this stuff from somewhere. Consequently, the Earth is being continuously explored, and these minerals are being recovered from wherever they occur. Now, some of this stuff is very, very common. For instance, famously, the Industrial Revolution was built on iron. And your listeners will be well aware that, famously, USA and North America in general has got pretty big supplies of iron ore. Australia's got even bigger supplies of iron ore. That's a plentiful material. Now, even exploitation of iron ore has effects on the environments where you're actually exploiting. So you have to reach some sort of arrangement, some agreement between people who want to support the nature and the environment and the organisms that live there and our actual demands. Now, iron ore is one thing, but there are all these other things that we need, especially some of the metals. And some of them are really quite rare. And what's been happening recently is that the sources for these, which are scattered all over the world, of course, it is, as you say, the developed world that is particularly keen on getting them. But that developed world is becoming bigger and bigger. After all, we've now got Brazil, large chunks of Africa, India, China, of course, Russia, all joining in on the demand for some of these materials, and their sources, as I say, are scattered over the world. Well, what's particularly happening is that some nations, particularly the Chinese, have actually, very cannily, if you look at it in one way, been buying up the actual sources, the lands on which these minerals are to be found. And they now own them, and they are going to control the exploitation of them. And that I think some other countries, ours in particular, America and Europe, have just really begun to wake up to the fact that some of these things that we need are held by, particularly by China. And China, of course, can then have demand certain prices, but this is the nature of the world economy. Now, what we have to do, of course, is, as I say, is to how can we balance our demands for materials with what happens to the people who are involved in the exploration and actual sort of mining of these materials, the environments where these occur. Now, often a lot of them are it's a question about a sight out of mind, and we have to be very careful about that. I think we in the West are becoming much more conscious, fortunately, of the conditions of the, in both the environment and the peoples who work in some of these mines in far-flung parts of the world. And we have to exercise our economic muscle and demand that there are, you know, that the conditions are reasonable and that the environmental damage is not too great. So it is, as I say, it's a global issue and it's a global problem, and we have to be more and more aware of it. But in the end, of course, we are also responsible because, you know, after all, we make the demands on for these materials. We want more cars, we want more mobile phones, we want more computers, and it's, you know, they don't just come out of the air. They're made of all these extraordinary different materials, and as the technology gets more sophisticated, in fact, the demand for rarer materials increases. So it's a very interesting problem. I'm glad you raised it. I'm not sure that I've been able to answer it very well, but you know, I think that the more aware we are of the problem, then hopefully, you know, we can address it and people can talk about it and be prepared to actually try and actually do something about it.
Thank you, June, very much for your question, as always. Let's talk about sponges. We are in a pledge drive, so we don't have much more time. But you talk about the fact that sponges, are a major development in the story of life, including our lives. How so?
Well, it's just that we've just discovered in recent decades that sponges are amongst the most ancient of animals, and they're extraordinary animals. You know, when you look at a sponge, you think, gosh, it's not an animal. You know, if anything,
right,
it has to be a plant.
Yeah.
But they're not. They are actually very primitive animals, and they're very curious animals as well, because they kind of bridge the gap between animals that are just single-celled organisms, like the famous amoeba that I'm sure everybody's heard of, or Euglena, or things like this, and multicelled organisms like ourselves. Quite a lot of the sponges are kind of just colonial aggregates. In other words, they're clumps of cells that can cooperate together to produce this organism called a sponge. And the more you look into it, the more extraordinary it is. I mean, it's just amazing what life can do, that you can get a few cells cooperating together, these cells that don't have any nerves, they don't have brains or anything like that, and yet somehow or other they cooperate together and they build little spines, and these spines go to build up the whole framework of the sponge. And this, as we say, that these are amongst the most primitive animals. And yet, when you look at the genetic makeup of the sponges, you identify elements of their genome that can be found in us today. So that, you know.
So they are the basis, is this going too far, of all animal life on this planet?
Well, it's not going too far. In fact, one has to go further than the sponges. Because in the end, even the most primitive single-celled organisms, the actual organic material that makes up their single cells is still basically the same as is found in not just our bodies, but in the bodies of plants as well. And so that, you know, there is a unity to life at the genetic molecular level. There's still some interesting problems about it, but what is remarkable and what, you know, molecular genetics has shown in recent decades, not only that all living humans basically Africans, but that all humans and all life actually does, as Darwin predicted, have a common ancestor that was some little kind of microbial single-celled organism living in the oceans, you know, several billion years ago. I mean, some people think it's horrendous thought, you know, that it's terrible. To me, that's just not so. I think it's just extraordinary. It's fascinating. And the real thing is, you know, how on earth did it get from that stage to where we are
right
today? And if you look at the fossil record, it gives you lots of clues. It tells you how that story happened. That's what's so great about the story.
Oh, it's also extraordinary. I just loved your book. It's beautiful and it's so important, and I feel like I'm on a journey to read it carefully now, chapter by chapter, so I'll know a lot more. That's why I love working here. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you. Please join us again when we have more time. We'd love to speak with you.
Well, thank you, and good morning, Wisconsin. Have a good day.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon in Cambridge, England. Douglas Palmer, our guest. The book is A History of Earth in 100 Groundbreaking Discoveries. I'm Kathleen Dunn, Rhonda Fanning joining me in our downtown Milwaukee studios. That's one of those, I can always tell when I really love a conversation because I hate to let it go and I keep thinking about having a person back. We do a lot of science programs, Rhonda. We both have a keen interest in science and I just love doing these programs.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Vincent Gaffney that we had on from the Institute of Archaeology and Antiquity, who made the discovery at Stonehenge. And then there's Hermann Pfefferkorn.
Hermann Pfefferkorn, the best discovery.
300-million-year-old forest in China. And then today, Douglas Palmer. So a lot of fun to be had here on the show.
Yeah, a lot of fun. We learn so much, don't we? And we're here to raise money in support of these kinds of programs you enjoy on the station. Please make your gift now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. The amount up to you. We appreciate every donation because every dollar you give makes a difference. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're looking for another 27 pledges in the next 6 minutes or so. So pledge now and you will help pay for the programs that you count on WPR. Thanks if you've already given this hour. But if not, please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I love that Douglas Palmer said, what a wonderful thing it was that we were asking for money so we could have shows on science. He just thought it was wonderful. To hear him say that made me think, yeah, it really is. It's wonderful. So take a few minutes to make this hour and many hours to come possible. Put a value on the programs that you enjoy every day. Make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And during this membership drive, we would like to say thanks for your support in a special way. When you pledge this drive at $120 to support the WPR programs that you listen to, you can choose a thank you gift that will provide 40 meals to a Wisconsin food bank in your local area.
We've done this before, and it's really a great program for those in need in your community. Pledge any amount right now. When you pledge $120, select Food for 40 as your thank you gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm Ari Shapiro, NPR's White House correspondent, and I'm here with Melissa Block, host of All Things Considered. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Ari.
We're here to talk to you about why public radio is worth whatever amount you want to give. Let's say $10 a month.
$10 a month. What could you buy for $10 a month? 10 songs on iTunes.
You know, I spend at least $10 a month making stupid impulse buys at the cash register of a grocery store. Here's a smart impulse buy. Pretend you're at the cash register of your local grocery store. Pick up a $10 donation to public radio, and as you're checking out, just toss it in the grocery bag.
It's $10 a month. You can think about it in terms of cups of coffee.
My Netflix bill is at least $10 a month, and God knows I listen to more public radio than I watch Netflix movies.
So whether it's $10 a month or some other amount that feels right to you, please give to your local station. And on behalf of all of us here at NPR, thank you for supporting what we do.
Thank you.
I'm Rhonda Fanning, here with Kathleen Dunn, the host of this program. We're here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listener support is such a big part of why this program is available to you right now. So please make your donation in support of the programs you count on each and every day at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We've had so many wonderful comments. David from Appleton made a pledge and said, Wisconsin Public Radio is one of the best things about Wisconsin. I'm a total WPR junkie. Many of you may fit that description. And if so, you may want to consider making a donation of $1,200. Listener support is crucial to our future, to our present. If you would like to do more than you've done before and can afford to make it a leadership contribution of $100 a month, please do that now. A gift of any amount appreciated, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We always try to be as timely as possible in choosing topics and guests to have on the show. Recently, we've had some great programs. Russ Feingold was on the program recently. Folks from the movie The Interrupters. I've had a lot of fun contacting NPR affiliates in different states for the GOP primaries and getting the reporters on the show.
Wonderful.
That's always
job
been
on that. Yeah.
It's just, maybe that's why the show has attracted so many loyal listeners, because you want to hear in-depth discussions that go beyond the daily headlines. And it's all made possible by listener contributions. So please make your contribution now. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
WPR.org, 888-202-2552. We are in a political year. Rest assured, Rhonda's going to get us the best guests. I've loved doing those shows with analysts from the states where the primaries have been held. And that's it's all just begun. There'll be much more of that to come. So pledge for what you will be hearing. We're looking for 26 more pledges in just the next 7 minutes or so. Make your pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thanks to everyone who have contributed this hour.
Yeah, by all means. And Rhonda, thank you so much for all that you do. Thanks, everybody, for being there and for pledging. Thanks a lot. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing and to Cynthia Schuster as well, to Katie Madsen for answering our phone calls, and thanks for your phone calls. More ahead on the Ideas Network.